Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess and a friend of Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to your iPod, iPad, or any other device like a computer and hit play. Today, we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing. One of the big challenges in the field is reducing the amount of ESI to review, because obviously the review is the most expensive part. And that seems to be the driving force behind the movement going on right now to amend the federal rules and clarify preservation obligations or clarify spoliation criteria into a clear standard. And it's also the same driving force behind the topic of this show, which is the new model order in patent cases, which Chief Judge Randall Rader of the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Federal Circuit on September 27th unveiled. The purpose of the model order was to limit e-discovery in patent cases. And on today's show, we're going to discuss the implications of the rule, go through some of its provisions, and weave in other ways to achieve maybe some of the same objectives that the rule has of using better search and retrieval techniques. So first, let's introduce our panelists. Okay, and Antigone Payton is the founder and CEO of Cloudigy Law, where she practices intellectual property, IP, and technology law. She counsels clients on trademark, patent, copyright, and trade secret issues, and drafts technology agreements, including licenses. Antigone has over a decade of industry and complex litigation experience and has helped clients ranging from startups to multinational companies protect and grow valuable IP assets. Having worked for both a trial and an appellate judge, she brings an insider's practical perspective to her litigation and client counseling practice. Before Cloudigy Law, Antigone worked at one of the largest IP firms in the world. For many years, interestingly, before law school, she worked as a scientist, conducting clinical and preclinical research and magnetic resonance studies at a large medical institution. Antigone also teaches other lawyers, law students, and companies about legal issues relating to e-discovery, social media, cloud computing, and international data transfer and privacy restrictions. She follows current news and research in these fields and applies best-of-breed technologies and processes to solve massive data preservation, collection, and review efforts in complex litigations involving terabytes of data. She also participates in the Sedona Conference dialogues on these topics, and has worked with her Sedona colleagues to craft commentaries and guidelines that cover legal and technical considerations relating to cloud computing and inactive data stores. Tom Grix is a partner in Schneider, Harrison, Siegel & Lewis's Litigation Services Department and chair of the firm's eDiscovery Practice Group. And like me, he's based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's primarily a trial attorney specializing in complex commercial litigation matters with particular emphasis on environmental and construction law industry. Prior to joining Schneider, Tom served as in-house environmental counsel with a Pittsburgh-based Fortune 100 company. He's also an engineer who went to Carnegie Mellon University, also like me. The use of Tom's engineering background when combined with his practical experiences as an in-house attorney assists him to create new and innovative workflows that use analytical search tools such as predictive coding to their greatest potential. Tom's also a special master in the Innovative Special Master Program for electronic discovery started by the federal courts in the Western District of Pennsylvania. Our last guest, Bruce Fine, is a legal director with Backstop LLC, a Washington, D.C.-based software analytics provider. His private practice experience encompasses general commercial litigation, securities investigations, antitrust law, including preclearance of market-leading mergers and other fields. He has overseen large-scale discovery projects involving both paper and electronic documents. Before forming Backstop, he was most recently an associate in the litigation group of the Washington, D.C. law firm Kellogg, Huber, Hanson, Todd, Evans, and Feigl, and was previously an associate at Sullivan and Cromwell. He's a member of the U.S. Army Reserves, in which capacity he served as an extended tour of duty in Iraq and was decorated with the Bronze Star Medal, which I believe makes him the first ESI Bytes guest to have military honors, joining Mike Lackey, who flew fighter jets. So he also formerly taught at the University of Chicago Law School and served as a law clerk for Judge Morton I. Greenberg of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Bruce received both his college and law degrees from the University of Chicago. So great, I love having you all on the show. What I like to start off, first of all, is to ask my guests how they first got started in electronic discovery. So why don't we start with you, Antigone, then Bruce, and then Tom.
Great, Carl. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for having me on ESI Bites. As I've told you before, I'm an avid listener, so I'm happy to participate in such an interesting show. So as with many of your guests, I started out on e-discovery issues really because I had to deal with these issues in a large litigation. It was about the 2003-2004 time period, and I was faced with a large client who had partially active and inactive data sets sitting on servers that hadn't been used for quite a while. The data wasn't indexed. They had backup tapes. You know, they had all the fun stuff that Judge Shindlin was dealing with in the Zubilate cases around the same time. So frankly, I just had to dig in and figure out how to deal with these issues and negotiate the landmines. And that led to where I am today. And I've developed a real love for this area as part of my IP practice.
Okay. How about yourself, Bruce?
Carl, thanks for having me. I got started basically as a young associate at Sullivan and Cromwell in the early 2000s. I had to put in my time supervising some large-scale document reviews for second requests and the like. And I had to review the bills that we were paying all of the dozens of contract attorneys to review the documents. And it occurred to me, as I reviewed their work, the great majority of documents could be classified very easily. You really did not need to pay an attorney to read most documents. There were some documents that were more difficult to classify where you would want an attorney to look at them. But I thought, you know, you really don't need a lawyer's education to classify most of these documents, most of the great bulk of them being non-responsive. It so happens that I had a friend I had known for a long time who was involved in the intelligence community, helping to use technology to sift through large amounts of data to find the interesting pieces. And we thought that technology could very readily be applied to the legal e-discovery problem, and that has proved to be the case.
Great. And how about you, Tom?
Thanks, Carl. You know, I've had a fairly inauspicious start to e-discovery. I've been involved in computing forever through my engineering studies at CMU. And then when I came to Schneider, I ended up being the only person in the Pittsburgh office who could communicate with our IS department. So that was many, many moons ago when we were trying to set up this office. So I've kind of stayed involved with the computing side of things. And because of that, several years ago, the chair of the litigation department simply asked me if I would agree to coordinate all of the efforts for Schneider in an e-discovery group that that I could then head. And I agreed to do that. And Schneider has kind of picked that up and asked me to push that as far as we can to benefit our clients and do what we can. So we've started to really pay attention to all of the more modern technologies and try to find ways to apply that. And so as head of the e-discovery group, I'm responsible for that for Schneider.
Okay. Well, let's start by talking about some of the components of the new model order. One of the first components that I noticed was this presumed exclusion of metadata from an e-discovery production request without a showing of good cause. Antigone is a patent attorney who understands e-discovery. What's your reaction to this approach?
It's an interesting provision, Carl, and frankly, it's a bit internally inconsistent. When you look at the order, it states that general ESI production requests under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 34 and 45 shall not include metadata absent a showing of good cause. It then goes on to say, however, fields showing the date and time that the document was sent and received, as well as the complete distribution list, shall generally be included in the production. So there's a couple of interesting things about this provision. First, it talks about general ESI production, whereas major portions of this order are really focused primarily on email production. So what this says to me is, as a general matter, the Federal Circuit is saying, look, you don't need to exchange all of this metadata. However, they then go on to say, okay, there's some metadata fields that are interesting, and they really do seem to focus on email. So the fields showing the date and time the document were sent and received, they've given those fields some special class and said, generally, those should be transferred between the parties. So if I'm looking at this model order and determining whether I'm going to apply it in a litigation, I think one of the first conversations I would have with the other side is, how are we going to interpret this and how are we going to apply it to our case so it's clear what our particular duties are with respect to email, if we're going to produce email, and with respect to other documents that have important metadata fields, but they're certainly not the sent and received fields.
Yeah, and I guess we should be clear. This is a model order. You're still meeting, conferring with the other side, and you can take pieces of it, I guess, if you want, if you can reach agreement and cooperate. So.
Carl, there's one point that I'd like to make about this from an e-discovery perspective. I've looked at it, and I agree with Judge Rader. Frankly, from a litigation perspective, metadata in and of itself is not very often necessary to grab. But as a practical matter, most collections are going to end up being forensic, in that metadata is going to end up being pulled with the native files, put into review databases, especially with PSTs, and exporting metadata is not going to be overly difficult. So I'm not sure that it's really necessary to impose that restriction from the get-go. And what happens is missing metadata, such as the date created on a document other than an email, is going to disrupt your cron story if you're trying to look at what's happening over time. So when I look at it from an e-discovery perspective, I say, you know, maybe it's not really necessary to do this, and there can be some problems that are created by eliminating metadata from the collection and production.
Tom, actually, I'm thinking of a project that we worked on together, actually, where we used a tool that absolutely requires metadata to enable you to laser in on your story.
Well, that's exactly right.
And, we went through hundreds of thousands of documents in 6 days to try to figure out the story. And if you had parsed out metadata, I don't know if the tool would have worked very well, because it needed more information, not less information, to try to sort the information quickly.
That's exactly right. So I see that a problem can be created when we have a per se exclusion of metadata, and frankly, from a practical perspective, I'm not sure that it changes the cost or review time that's associated with the ESI productions.
Bruce, you're a hardcore technologist. You work in the field, and you use advanced analytics. Can you think of reasons why you wouldn't want to exclude the metadata?
Well, definitely. There is our software at Backstop performs auto classification of documents, and metadata is a very useful, I would almost say, a key component of what we analyze when we're providing the predictive automated classifications. Typically, we see an increase in accuracy on the order of 10 to 15% when we do have access to metadata, as opposed to when we do not have access to metadata. And that's in addition to the forensic use, which you and Tom discussed, that it helps you figure out who was working on documents when, collaborating on a patent, can be used as impeachment evidence, serve as a clue as to whom a party should depose or whose document it should request. And as Tom pointed out, given the modern tools, there's a low marginal difficulty of production. That is, if you're going to produce any ESI, then producing all of the metadata is not very difficult.
Carl, I want to make a point about metadata that's associated with some of the databases that clients use when they're creating complicated technology. Sometimes it is very difficult to identify metadata that can be extracted from these complex data structures. And there can be some benefits of having a default rule that says, as a general matter, we're not going to pull metadata from these types of systems. And if you want it, you have to show particularized need why you're going to get this. SAP is one example, right? It's a data structure where it's very difficult to do anything other than run reports out of the system to get some useful information relating to financials, damages issues in a patent case and things of that nature. Some people ask for metadata there, but really what that can mean is you're exporting data that's not going to make any sense outside of its native system, or you're going to have to replicate that native SAP environment in another location. And both of those situations are very problematic.
I guess it's just it goes to show, as always with e-discovery, there's no one simple answer. It always depends on what you're looking at. So, well, let's go into another probably the most interesting component of the model order is how it treats email. And email production requests must be for specific issues, not general discovery of a product or business. In addition, the email production requests are delayed until after disclosures about the patents, the accused uses of the invention, relevant financial information, and the prior art, published information about the subject matter of the claimed invention, including issued patents. So, Antigone, as a patent lawyer, what do you think the judge is trying to contain here, and do you think the emails are less important in patent cases?
You know, it's interesting. My experience has been that emails are very useful during the discovery phase of the case. They often contain some information that may be inconsistent with official records. They may invite uncomfortable discussions for witnesses. So a lot of attorneys like to use emails to really shake witnesses up before they get to the foundational documents that relate to the issues in their case. However, as we all know, emails are very expensive. If you're putting eyes on the emails and the attachments, trying to deal with privilege issues, creating of privilege logs, redactions, and things of that nature. So from a practical perspective, when I look at our final trial list, I really do see very few and sometimes no emails on the trial list or in the list of documents that are actually provided to the jury at trial. So, you know, I'm not sure I'm with them when they say, let's, you know, put those away, they're less important. But I agree that they're in a very expensive set of data to deal with. And I know that my clients spend a lot of money dealing with emails when ultimately they really don't impact the final case that's presented at trial.
So, Tom, as an e-discovery lawyer, where that's where you do all your focus or much of it, do you have any problems with this approach also? Or?
Well, my reaction starts from the litigation perspective, and I think Antigone pointed it out, and that is, the emails in discovery are very, very useful to develop the story, and missing those emails causes gaps in the story. And from a litigation perspective, I actually don't like to distinguish between types of responsive information, whether it's paper or ESI. If one type of document is available, it seems to me they should all be available. From a pure e-discovery standpoint, I don't think it's overly problematic to implement this, but there are a couple of concerns. First is, I don't think it's going to limit your preservation or collection efforts, because although the model order says we're going to take this approach from the beginning, all of this data may become available at some point later in time, some of it subject to cost shifting. So you still have to end up preserving and probably collecting a lot of these emails anyway. And it may limit production the way it's structured, but again, from an e-discovery perspective, I'm not sure that's necessary, because as Bruce will tell you, advanced analytical techniques, things like predictive coding, will effectively be able to cull through these massive amounts of data. So whether you're on the producing side or the receiving side, you can actually manage it and start to focus in on the documents that are going to build your story. The fact that those don't get used at trial as evidence in and of themselves isn't surprising, because at the end of the day, you have the witness. That document only becomes evidence if you have to impeach the witness or show exactly what was said on a specific date. So from an e-discovery perspective, I don't think it's necessary. I think it can be implemented, but I don't think it's necessary.
Now, one of the biggest items in the model rule is this limitation on the number of custodians where email will be produced at 5, and the search terms per custodian, which is also 5 terms. There's, of course, the option for a litigant to pay for more than 5 of the custodian's emails. And Tom, from an e-discovery perspective, how can you be comfortable starting out with 5 custodians when you know nothing about the case yet, or very little? And consider the size of the company. Say a company has 5 employees, might be not so hard. But what if they have 10,000 employees?
Well, from an e-discovery perspective, I don't actually like this limitation because it seems arbitrary and unnecessary. Again, it's not going to limit preservation because there's not going to be a cap. At the end of the day, you can get more custodians. And it may complicate collection because you may have to do stepwise collection. And it's going to cause delays. It's going to complicate data analysis potentially because the advanced analytical tools allow you to put all of this data into the tool and then start to look at the issues and have the computer start to identify the documents that really relate to the case. That becomes more complicated when there are different types of data that are being put into the tool over different periods of time. For example, if you focused first on 5 research scientists who worked on this product and you put them into the tool, you're going to see something slightly different when you start to add, say, 5 accountants or 5 marketers. So you won't be able to optimize the value of the analytical tools, such as predictive coding, if you have to go through this entire stepwise process.
That's interesting. But there might be some, you know, unique requirements of patent law cases or the structure that maybe they're like employment law cases where you don't have to dig as deep. Do you think 5 is a reasonable number in patent cases, Antigone, since you work in this area?
Carl, when this came out, I contacted a number of people I know who are in-house at serial companies who are involved in serial patent litigations. The unanimous response was, are you kidding me? That is a very low number. And they felt the same way even in a case where a non-practicing entity might be on the other side. Often they feel that they've got prior technology that can invalidate the patent. They've got their own story to tell. And they felt that 5 was just too few to be able to really develop that story, as Tom mentioned, and get an understanding of how best to present it to the jury.
So, look, Carl, I would also add that given the limitations of search terms, 5 is preposterously low. We have often found terms like project code names or different names for products or drugs or projects that have meaning and importance for the case, which would not have been known and could not have been known, certainly by an adverse party in advance without actually looking at the document. We haven't seen custodial limitations in our practice, but I'm sure the same is true of custodians. But it seems to me far, far too narrow a restriction.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The CLEs that I've been giving, I've actually started on this area. I've started having people in the audience play Go Fish with each other. I hand out cards. And even with a contained number of cards, people have trouble, and knowing roughly what's in the deck, have trouble matching someone else's cards. So it sounds simple enough to say we're going to want this or that, but it's really an art. I mean, all the Sedona guidelines and people that have worked in this space say, it's iterative. Your first attempt might not work, your second, your third, your fourth, this isn't about using search terms effectively. At least I hate talking about using search terms effectively. I'd rather go to the next question first.
Right.
Which is,
Carl,
do you believe there are other ways?
But before he goes in, I was going to pretty much say that I think Bruce will tell you that perhaps the search terms aren't the way to go anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Tom anticipates my answer because the Judge Blair's order assumes that keyword searching is the way to go and that's how you're going to request email. I think that approach would be very misguided, both as a presumption underpinning the order and from the perspective of an attorney who is formulating an e-discovery request. Past research, including the Blair and Marin study of 1985, which has been much bandied about, has shown a tremendous gap between and what an attorney thinks he's able to get by keyword searching and what you actually get, particularly when you don't know in advance what exactly you're looking for. In that particular study, there were 40,000 documents, and lawyers were given unlimited rein to perform keyword searches, and they thought that they had found 75% of the documents, and in fact, they had only found about 20% of the documents. Technology such as predictive coding, auto-coding, is much more accurate than keyword searching, or than attorney review alone, for that matter, both on recall and precision. For the benefit of your listeners, I'll just give quick definitions of those terms. Recall is of the percentage of documents that you should have found and produced, what percentage did you find and produce? And that is where human reviewers have traditionally been found to lag far behind technology, on the order of 40 to 50%, even in a linear review context. Attorneys typically achieve 40 to 50% recall. Precision is the flip side of the material that you did produce, what percentage of that material is actually relevant as opposed to extraneous. And so I think that the order is a bit of a blunt instrument, not only because of the limitations on the numbers of search terms and custodians, but because it assumes that search terms are the way to go. And I think that assumption is very much in question. And it also overlooks the fact that once you have to search any custodian and apply any search terms, the marginal cost of additional custodians and additional search terms tends to be rather small. I don't want to sound too critical. As the Northern DCG Systems case alluded to, picking up on Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes's aphorism that the lifeblood of the law is not logic but experience, this is an experiment and it can be adjusted on a case-by-case basis as circumstances indicate, and we'll see whether or not it usually works or usually gets modified that will determine its serviceability. But I have to say the assumption that search terms are the way to go, I think, is misguided.
Yeah, I'm going to switch from moderator to panelist here. I sometimes do this, but one of the observations I have in this area, I was just at a presentation in Cleveland, a judicial panel where people are talking about e-discovery, and one of the guests or people in the audience said, we're trying very hard to control the cost and trying to keep, the use of consultants and technologists down so that these things don't cost an arm and a leg and we can do these cases more efficiently. And I think that nails the problem right with the hammer, because this is a technological problem. And trying to do this without embracing technologists and bringing them to the table to work with the people working on the rules is sort of like going into a fire without water, you know, as a fireman, you know, or a small hose or a water pistol. And that seems to be one of the challenges out there is how do you get lawyers to really embrace partnering with technologists to solve these problems instead of trying to solve these problems from 10,000 feet in a litigation or judicial process. I don't appear in court very often, so I think, you know, we do want to try to solve the problem, and I applaud the judge for trying to do that. The next section I actually thought was I liked the model order, which follows the thinking of Rule 502 and preserves privilege against waiver for inadvertent production and allows a party to stop a litigant from using any discovery that the party asserts is privilege. And Tom, I know you've recently published an article about 502. First of all, what do you think about these provisions and what's your thought about the language in there of inadvertent production?
Well, I think it's fantastic to have a model order that presumes that 502D will apply and can be used to protect privileges. I think that's fantastic. And I think, frankly, we should be moving in that direction because either the lawyers or the courts should make sure that 502D is used. But the problem with the order the way it's drafted now is it drops short of what 502D will give you because it deals only with inadvertent production. And frankly, 502D allows you, at its fullest implication, to produce documents without even looking at them and still protect against waiver of the privilege. And in Judge Grimm's article, he suggests that limiting this to inadvertent is somewhat of a misapplication of 502D, and I'd suggest that by limiting it to inadvertent production, you're going to have a little bit of a problem with the extent of the protection of privileges in other lawsuits should you produce something through a process that doesn't have a rigorous, very rigorous privilege review, which really isn't called for by 502D.
So I was recently sent a case. Brian Panda at Wiley Ryan has done podcasts with us before, saw that we were going to do this show, and he's also an IP lawyer. He sent me a case that adopted the model rules called DCG Systems, Inc. versus Checkpoint Technologies, LLC. It came out of the U.S. District Court from the Northern District of California on November 2nd, 2011. And this case was between two commercial entities, one of whom sought to use the new model order and one of whom opposed the model order. And, you know, the court held the model order would be used and found it compelling that you know, one analysis they looked at, 0.0074% of the documents produced actually make their way in the trial exhibit list, which is less than one document in 10,000. But we've already touched upon, you know, the discovery versus the trial list. So, Tiffany, what's your reaction to this holding when two parties who are direct competitors and likely had similar ESI burdens are coming out on different sides of this issue?
Well, I think this gets back to the conversation that I've had with clients where they've lived in one world for so long and there's things that they would change about it, but when such a drastic change has been imposed on them, they have a hard time moving to the other side. So my sense from this case is there was a party who was very concerned that they weren't going to get enough useful information relating to the claims and defenses in the case. But what's really interesting about this order is the judge compliments both parties for coming to the table and having a meaningful 26F conference and really hashing through the e-discovery issues. And it seems to me that that kind of communication and cooperation between the parties to find common areas where they could agree and then areas where they disagreed allowed this judge to really get into the weeds, figure out whether or not this model order should apply, and said, you know, I get what Judge Rader is talking about with the low value of emails in most cases. And what this order says is, I'm going to adopt this. We're going to try this out. This is the type of thing that the Federal Circuit said, you know, we just need to try it and see how it goes. And I'm not precluding the parties from coming back if a need is shown in the future and we can revisit this. My door is open when and if you need to walk in. But what's going to be interesting is to see whether the party who didn't get its way is going to walk in that door and really what evidence or facts they're going to be able to use to show that they need additional information. Because one thing that we find in our cases is once we really start to drill down into all this information using computer assistance, we get a bigger sense of the story and we find avenues of discovery that, frankly, we wouldn't have thought of even after the initial disclosures were exchanged between the parties and they engaged in their initial discussions. And that's just what happens in these cases. They're big, the issues are complex, and you learn more every day as you spend time on a case and on the technology and on the issues.
And you mentioned the cooperation proclamation and how these parties really tried to meet and come to a resolution. You know, how do you think this model order plays out with cooperation? Do you think the parties can solve these problems better than relying on a model order?
I think as a general matter, if both parties' counsel and the parties themselves are ready to sit down and have meaningful discussions, the cooperation proclamation can work very well. But one thing we always talk about in our Sedona meetings and in discussions among ESI professionals is the problem with education of attorneys and their lack of understanding of the value of sitting down and having these discussions. You know, not so long ago in the old days, the prevailing theory was hold your cards close to the chest, don't tell them what you have. When you're ready to give it to the other side, give it at the last minute. But frankly, ESI makes that an untenable process now. That doesn't mean that people have switched from the old point of view to a view that focuses on cooperation for the mutual benefit of their clients. So I think cooperation can do great things if both sides cooperate. But what model orders like this does, you know, whether it's Judge Robinson's model order in Delaware or this model order or the Seventh Circuit e-discovery standards, it provides an additional lever for the court to require the parties to come to the table and have discussions. And the alternative is the court's going to impose particular restrictions that neither party is going to be happy with.
Yeah, and I should mention the Fulbright and Jaworski litigation report just came out, and in that survey, it appeared that only 40% of the respondents were using the cooperation proclamation. So I guess we still have a lot of educating to do there, as you pointed out. Tom, do you think this that having an arbitrary approach like this can work when we don't know the case until we've looked at the evidence? Now that we've gone through the podcast, or I know you came out strongly against that.
Generally, I don't like it. And I think what Antigone was talking about kind of explains why. As you go through this process and start to look at data, you see more and more threads that you need to pull through to find out where they're going to take you. What's going to happen with an arbitrary rule is you may not even see some of those threads or alleyways. Some of them will be cut off. And that will require you to continually go back to court and say, look, now I need additional information. I have to get into this. I have to get into that. These issues have come up. And frankly, it will probably be something that's necessary. Using advanced analytics, using predictive coding, it is much easier to understand your case by taking the data, putting it in, and then starting to have the computer tell you, as you're looking through these documents, say these are important to me, the computer will cull them down and tell you these are the documents that are important, and you can start to learn your entire case much, much more than if you impose arbitrary limits. So I'm not a fan of it, and frankly, I don't think it's really necessary given the capabilities that we have today.
So, Bruce, I did my rant earlier about, you know, how we solve the problem by getting people like you involved earlier. So as a technologist, do you want a seat at the table to try to figure out ways to reduce the cost of e-discovery using tools, or are we okay just reacting to the rules that judges and lawyers come up with based on what they're seeing in court?
Well, certainly I think that technology can serve as a more precise instrument than some of the blunt methods we have discussed, like keyword searching, to advance the cause of efficient discovery. And technology can serve to provide guidance or direction to judges and parties in crafting discovery orders. I think the most significant fact is that a technology-assisted review can be more accurate, I would dare say much more accurate, than an attorney review, even when you only review a small fraction of potentially responsive documents. Attorney review, even a linear review, will often find 40 to 50% of the responsive documents. With a technology-assisted review, you can achieve statistically significant confidence that you have found 90 or 95% of the responsive documents while reviewing a small fraction, typically from 10 to 30% of the potentially responsive documents. We have actually achieved 90% recall and 70% precision after our client has reviewed less than one half of 1% of the documents. So I think that technology-assisted review can be much more effective for both sides than, say, keyword searching or linear review, the pitfalls of which I think are well known to the e-discovery community.
Yeah, before I started a podcast a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to one of the panelists about the same issue, a similar issue, and why lawyers weren't accepting these tools very quickly at all. It's in the press, you know, it's being written about, but really it's very much under the radar what people are experimenting. And my reaction was, one of my panelists said, we've been literally screwed by vendors before, and so we're going to be slow on this. And my reaction was, I've looked at, you know, virtually every tool in the marketplace, and they all work better than what we're doing today. I don't care which one you pick. You're going to see improvements. And it was interesting. The judge who was on the show picked up on it and talked about that later on in the podcast. Antigone, as I talked about at the beginning of the show, doesn't this sound a lot like the discussions about the new federal rules which are being discussed, where we want to limit the amount of custodians that are picked and try to be upfront with safe harbors for preservation? There's this threat out there of trying to do anything we can to limit e-discovery costs. Although I got to say, from what I've seen, no one is anywhere near coming up with a consensus on a rule that would work.
Yeah, that's right, Carl. I think there's wide recognition that the scope of preservation is a huge issue for companies. We don't have a specific rule within the federal rules that provides guidance on preservation. It's a matter of common law. And what a lot of companies are doing, because they're concerned about the risk of sanctions when the court's engaging in Monday morning quarterbacking with the other party, that they're going to be accused of hiding things, of deleting things on purpose. And so as a general rule, they're taking a very broad view of preservation. The other reason why they take a broad review or broad view of preservation is they frankly don't know what's going to be relevant at the beginning, either under the federal rules or really important for the final case. They're investigating at the same time the other side is, and I frankly, in a lot of my cases, we find things as we go, and the information that was not on our radar at the beginning became highly relevant and important later as we learned more about the technology and the issues in the case. So there's a number of practical and court-driven reasons why parties are trying to preserve broadly and generally are doing so. That's a huge expense for the company. It you know, really takes out on the bottom line. It's very burdensome for the business. It takes them away from their core business. So there's been a lot of discussion about how we deal with this issue. Some have said we need something specific in the federal rules, and then the question comes up, well, what do you put in there? How do you describe the scope of preservation? Do you put particular factors in? Do you make some basic narrow rule and apply it to all types of litigation, patent, employment, federal investigations, things of that nature? Or do we do something like we do with depositions? We just say, okay, 30 custodians, we're going to preserve their information, and let's say 15 different non-individual custodians, we're going to say 15 different databases also have to be preserved in all cases. That's our default, and if you want more, you have to come to court and show good cause to get more. And, you know, it's really hard to fashion a rule that fits all of these different situations, and I think that's why, as you point out, we're really struggling with what we do to respond to what's generally perceived to be a huge problem.
Well, the last question I've added in here on recent shows is couldn't be unrelated to the topic, but since you're each experts in the space, I like to just get your sense of what you see as the biggest issue in electronic discovery right now at this point in time, which is November 11th, 2011. So why don't we start with you just answered Antigone, so you're going to go last. Why don't we start with Bruce, then Tom, then Antigone?
Okay, well, the niche of e-discovery in which I work is sufficiently narrow that I can't claim to have a bird's eye view of the entire e-discovery space. But from my perspective, the biggest issue is the idea that expensive attorney review is the gold standard of accuracy. I think that is a misperception that is held by both courts and law firms. With a proper workflow, technology-assisted review can yield significantly more accurate production, certainly more accurate than keyword searching, and more accurate than linear review, whereby attorneys look at every document. It will also save time and expense, which can add up to hundreds of thousands, and in some cases, millions of dollars in a single case, because you only need to review a small fraction of the overall document set in order to achieve that superior accuracy.
Okay, Tom?
Just really picking up where Bruce left off, I think you actually stated it best. What I see as one of the biggest problems right now is getting lawyers over their fears and having them learn to partner with technology to make this e-discovery work in an efficient, cost-effective manner, because it can be done.
Okay. And Antigone, you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think both Bruce and Tom identified a very important issue. For my cases, there's another issue which is frankly more important, and that's the complexity of the data structures that my clients have developed and the location of that data. And this brings in really cloud computing as part of the issue. I'm seeing more and more of these issues pop up in each case, and they're always different. So for me, I really struggle with how we get the right information and appropriate information out of these complex data structures. And I'm hopeful that, you know, the area that Bruce is working in and that we're talking about, computer-assisted review and predictive coding, will be able to be applied to these data sets that I'm seeing more and more.
Okay, well, I wanted to thank all of you, Antigone, Bruce, and Tom, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have guests such as yourselves share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Shineman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.